In the last lecture, we talked about black holes. Today, physicists are in agreement that black holes are a clear prediction of Einstein's general theory of relativity. And furthermore, black holes actually exist in our universe, being formed through the collapse of very massive stars. But Einstein never came to believe that this was true. I strongly suspect that if he had lived long enough to see the direct evidence of black holes, Einstein would have changed his mind. But by the time he died in 1955, Einstein still refused to accept the possibility that black holes might actually exist. In this lecture, I'm going to talk about another consequence of general relativity. And similar to black holes, this is a prediction that Einstein rejected, at least for a time. And it's a prediction that was ultimately shown to be true. What I'll be talking about in this lecture is a strange phenomenon known as gravitational waves. Gravitational waves are moving, periodic variations in the curvature of space. To better understand what I mean by this, it can be helpful to think about gravitational waves in analogy to other kinds of waves. A water wave, for example, is a moving, periodic variation in the height of a water surface. And a sound wave is a moving pattern of alternating regions of high and low pressure. And just like water waves or sound waves, gravitational waves carry energy as they move forward through space. In the pre-Einstein Newtonian view of gravity, there is no such thing as a gravitational wave. Instead, all of the effects of gravity were thought to move instantaneously across space. This instantaneous motion didn't leave open any possibility of wave-like behavior for gravity. But in general relativity, this was all very different. Even the effects of gravity are limited by the speed of light. And Einstein's field equations do have valid solutions in which the waves of gravity can move through space. Unlike in the case of black holes, Einstein did not immediately reject the notion of gravitational waves. Shortly after he completed his general theory of relativity in 1915, Einstein reached the conclusion that moving objects could, under certain circumstances, create ripples or vibrations in the very fabric of space and time. These rippling waves carry energy, and they propagate through space at the speed of light. At some level, this isn't too surprising that Einstein's field equations allow for the formation and propagation of gravitational waves. As a point of comparison, consider the equations that physicists use to describe the phenomena of electricity and magnetism. These are known as Maxwell's equations. One of the solutions of Maxwell's equations is a combination of an oscillating electric and an oscillating magnetic field. Together, these time-varying electric and magnetic fields move through space at the speed of light. In fact, this combination of oscillating electric and magnetic fields is nothing more than the thing that we actually call light. Light is itself an electromagnetic wave. In close analogy to this, Einstein's field equations have solutions which correspond to a propagating wave of oscillating curvature of space-time. These gravitational waves travel through space at the same speed as light, and they require no medium other than that of space and time itself. Initially, most physicists thought that gravitational waves were probably real, although they knew that they'd be very difficult to detect or study. But gradually, attitudes toward gravitational waves began to shift towards skepticism and even disbelief. For example, in 1922, the famous physicist and astronomer Arthur Eddington wrote a paper in which he argued against the existence of gravitational waves, arguing that these solutions to the field equations were mere mathematical artifacts and that they didn't have any self-consistent physical meaning. When Einstein made his first calculations involving gravitational waves back in 1916, he had used a common method of approximation known as perturbation theory. In the 1930s, he became interested once again in this kind of phenomena, but this time he was determined to avoid the use of any approximations. Instead, Einstein wanted to find exact gravitational wave solutions to his field equations. This led Einstein to reach a very different conclusion than the one he had reached back in 1916. After taking all the details of the math into account, Einstein became convinced that nothing like a stable propagating gravitational wave could really exist. Instead, he thought that gravitational waves were just a mathematical artifact that was somehow connected to the approximations that he had made in the earlier versions of his calculations. He now thought that any gravitational waves would instantly collapse. Such a failed wave couldn't possibly carry any energy, and it wouldn't have any measurable effects. About all of this, we now know that Einstein was simply wrong. So in 1936, Einstein and his assistant, Nathan Rosen, wrote a paper which was entitled, Do Gravitational Waves Exist? In this paper, Einstein laid out the details of his new calculation and his argument for why gravitational waves are impossible. Since immigrating to the United States a few years earlier, Einstein had been publishing his results in a number of different American journals. This case was no exception, and he sent his paper to the American journal, The Physical Review. In the past, the editor of the Physical Review had simply published Einstein's submissions without any delay. These earlier papers were never sent to a referee and never underwent any serious peer review. It's pretty hard to imagine this happening to any paper today, by the way. Well, in any case, this time the editor was more skeptical of Einstein's result. So he decided that he should send it to an independent referee in order to get their opinion on the paper. The referee in this case was a respected scientist and one who specialized in the subject of relativity. He was just the kind of person that would make a good referee for Einstein's paper. In the course of the review, the referee identified a crucial mistake that Einstein had made in his calculation. The full explanation of this problem is a bit technical, but at its essence, the problem is that Einstein had made a poor choice for the system of coordinates that he had used, leading him to misinterpret some of his results. This kind of problem is not uncommon in general relativity. It's one that even an adept physicist might occasionally make. In fact, these kinds of mathematical pitfalls weren't really sorted out in detail until the 1950s. But in any case, the referee pointed out that if one had instead used a different, yet perfectly valid choice of coordinates, the problems that Einstein had identified would have vanished. In this other coordinate system, there were perfectly valid gravitational wave solutions to the field equations. Today, physicists agree that this conclusion is correct. In this exchange, the referee was right and Einstein was wrong. But in my view, this was not the most important mistake that Einstein made in this story. Instead, where Einstein really screwed up was in the way that he responded to the referee's report. This report was something that he should have seen as helpful. But instead of learning from the report and using it to correct his calculation, Einstein got angry. Shortly after receiving the report, Einstein wrote to the editor of the Physical Review. Let me read for you what he wrote. Dear sir, we, Mr. Rosen and I, had sent you our manuscript for publication and did not authorize you to show it to specialists before it is printed. I see no reason to address the, in any case, erroneous comments of your anonymous expert. On the basis of this incident, I prefer to publish the paper elsewhere. Einstein swore that he would never again publish his work in the Physical Review, and he never did. In other words, Einstein took his toys and went home. Soon after withdrawing his paper from the Physical Review, Einstein submitted it to another journal, the Journal of the Franklin Institute, which quickly agreed to accept it. But before this article is actually printed or published, some interesting events took place. The anonymous referee that had written the critical report of Einstein's paper turns out to have been the physicist Howard Percy Robertson. In the summer of that same year, Robertson finished a sabbatical at Caltech and returned to Princeton, the very place that Einstein lived and worked. Once back in Princeton, Robertson happened to meet Einstein's new assistant, Leopold Infeld. In a conversation they had, Robertson apparently managed to convince Infeld that there was an error in Einstein's paper. This must have put Infeld in a difficult position. He surely knew about the incident with the Physical Review, and he probably thought that Einstein, who was his boss after all, would not want to hear these criticisms yet again. But when Infeld told Einstein about his conversation with Robertson, Einstein was surprisingly calm, and not even very surprised. As it turns out, by this time, it seems that Einstein had started to reach a similar conclusion on his own, perhaps aided by the arguments that had been laid out several months before in Robertson's report. Or not. It's hard to say for sure what exactly did the most to change Einstein's mind. But in any case, Einstein did change his mind. The paper that Einstein had sent to the Journal of the Franklin Institute hadn't hit the presses yet, so Einstein took this opportunity to send a corrected version to them before it was too late. Among other changes, Einstein changed the title of his article from "Do Gravitational Waves Exist?" to simply "On Gravitational Waves." He no longer argued that gravitational waves were impossible, and even presented a solution to the field equations that correspond to a specific kind of gravitational wave, what is called a cylindrical gravitational wave. As the dust gradually settled on this debate, it remained unclear to many physicists whether or not gravitational waves really exist. And if they did exist, it was far from obvious whether we'd ever be able to detect one or measure its effects. In principle, almost any gravitational system will generate gravitational waves. Even the Earth moving around the Sun releases a steady flux of rippling space-time. The problem is that the effects of these waves are very, very small. As the Earth releases gravitational waves into space, it loses a very little bit of energy, causing its orbit to shrink. In other words, the Earth is steadily moving closer and closer to the Sun, but not very quickly at all. This rate is less than a billionth of a meter every 1,000 years. You can rest assured that the Earth will not be falling into the Sun anytime soon. And you can see why it might be hard to measure an effect that is so astonishingly small. But even if the Sun and Earth don't produce any significant amount of gravitational waves, some physicists and astronomers thought that there might exist other astrophysical bodies in the universe that would produce far more. In particular, in the mergers of very massive and very compact objects, like neutron stars and black holes, it was expected that huge amounts of energy would be released in the form of gravitational waves. If scientists could somehow build the right instrument, perhaps they could detect the effects of the gravitational radiation from these kinds of objects. Over most of history, the practice of astronomy was limited to what one could see with our own eyes. Sure, astronomers had used telescopes for centuries to see fainter and more distant objects, but these observations were still limited to light in the visible range of wavelengths. But by the middle of the 20th century, astronomers had begun to use a wide range of instruments and telescopes to detect many other and different kinds of light. These new kinds of telescopes could detect not only visible light, but also ultraviolet and infrared radiation, as well as X-rays, gamma rays, radio waves, and microwaves. Astronomy was no longer just about using lenses and mirrors to see visible images of distant objects. It had expanded to encompass the detection of many different kinds of light waves. Perhaps, some astronomers started to ask themselves, gravitational waves could be added to this list as well. Some of the first efforts to detect gravitational waves were carried out in the 1960s and 70s, using devices known as Weber bars, named after the physicist Joseph Weber. These Weber bars consisted of large cylinders of aluminum, usually a couple of meters long. It was thought that a passing gravitational wave could cause these objects to vibrate slightly. The problem was that there were lots of other things that might cause these cylinders to vibrate as well, a passing truck, for example. To limit these backgrounds as much as they possibly could, the bars were carefully protected and isolated from ordinary forms of vibration. The scientists also used multiple Weber bars at the same time, sometimes separated by thousands of miles. If all of these Weber bars were triggered at the same time, you would know that it wasn't because of a passing truck, but it might be from a gravitational wave that was passing through the entire Earth. As it turns out, Weber bars were never sensitive enough to detect gravitational waves. Many claims of detection were made over the years, but other scientists were never able to successfully reproduce these results, and eventually the claims of detection were discredited. We now know that the successful detection of a gravitational wave requires a much more ambitious experimental program. I'll come back to the story of these experiments in just a few minutes. In the 1970s, there weren't any experiments that were capable of directly detecting a gravitational wave. But in 1974, the radio astronomers Joe Taylor and Russell Hulse detected a new kind of stellar system that would allow them to at least indirectly see the effects of gravitational radiation. This system consisted not only of a neutron star, but of two neutron stars, spinning around each other in a close orbit. This system was the first binary pulsar to ever be observed. A pulsar is a neutron star that is rapidly spinning on its axis. Whereas the Earth spins on its axis once per day, a typical pulsar makes this kind of rotation once every second or so. The radio waves that we see from these kinds of objects come in regular and periodic pulses. To understand why, picture a spinning flashlight. If you're standing in the right place, once per revolution of the flashlight, it will point in your direction, creating a brief flash of light. A spinning neutron star powers two intense beams of radio waves, like a flashlight that projects light out of both of its ends. To an observer in the right place, these radio beams will point in the direction once or even twice per revolution. This is what creates the pulses. The discovery of a system with two neutron stars, this binary pulsar, was very important and very valuable to astronomers. Among other reasons, the system provided us with an opportunity to test many of the predictions of general relativity, some of which had never been tested at that point in time. Near a very massive and compact object like a neutron star, the effects of gravity are very strong. According to general relativity, the strong gravity causes time to pass more slowly near a neutron star than it does elsewhere. The radio pulsations observed by astronomers act like a naturally occurring clock. Physicists and astronomers recognized early on that they could use this clock to study how gravity affects the passage of time near these neutron stars. When two neutron stars are closest to each other, the amount of time that passes between pulses is lengthened. Time is stretched. And when the neutron stars are farthest away from each other, time is less strongly affected, and the pulses speed up toward their normal rate. As physicists scrutinized the system, they found that these weird distortions of time were taking place just as Einstein's theory predicted that they should. Another thing that astronomers could measure about this binary pulsar was how the orbits of the neutron stars were changing with time. I mentioned before that the Earth's motion around the Sun is expected to create a very small amount of gravitational radiation, so small that we can't even hope to detect it anytime in the foreseeable future. But in the case of these two neutron stars, the effects of gravity are wildly greater than anything in our own solar system. This powerful gravity experienced by these neutron stars should create and release a great deal of energy in the form of gravitational radiation. As the gravitational waves steadily remove energy from the system, the orbits of these neutron stars will slow down, and the time between pulses should increase, albeit very slightly. If this slowing could be measured, it would provide the first indirect evidence that gravitational waves were being created. Over a decade or so following the discovery of this binary pulsar, astronomers were able to detect that the rate of its pulsations are in fact slowing down. This was the first real observational evidence of gravitational waves. They are really being created. Furthermore, these astronomers measured this rate very precisely, finding it to be about 76 millionths of a second per year. This is an almost perfect match to the rate that is predicted by the equations of general relativity, within a fraction of 1% of the predicted value. So Einstein's theory survived yet another high-precision test. Like I said in Lecture 2, maybe one day we'll find some circumstance where Einstein's theory fails, but nothing like that has been found so far. The careful and precise observations of this binary pulsar provided scientists with the first indirect evidence that gravitational waves exist. But many astronomers and physicists weren't entirely satisfied with this indirect evidence. They wanted to know more about gravitational waves and how they form and how they behave. To do that, they needed to see the effects of these waves directly and to directly measure the ripples of space and time that they create as they move through the universe. The strategy that would ultimately enable scientists to accomplish this goal is an experimental technique known as laser interferometry. In a laser interferometer, a laser beam is split into two separate beams. These two laser beams then travel in two different directions, usually perpendicular to each other, before being reversed by mirrors. In the end, the two laser beams are brought back together and recombined into a single beam. Imagine for a second that the two paths through space taken by these two different laser beams are exactly the same in length. In this case, when the two laser beams are recombined, the shapes of their waves will align perfectly with each other. The peaks and valleys of the two beams will all be at the same places. When this kind of alignment happens, the two laser beams reinforce each other, making them brighter. This is known as constructive interference. But now imagine that one of the mirrors is moved by a very short distance, slightly lengthening the path of one of the laser beams. Now, in this case, when the two beams are recombined, their waves may or may not align with each other. And if they don't, then the peak of one beam's wave might cancel against the valley of another beam's wave, dimming the total amount of light. This is called destructive interference. Whether two laser beams and an interferometer will interfere with each other constructively or destructively depends on the precise difference between the lengths of their paths. If one of those paths changes even slightly, by a few hundred nanometers or so, the recombined light shifts from a bright pattern of constructive interference to a dim pattern of destructive interference. Laser interferometry is a very powerful way to measure very small changes in distance. So to understand why a laser interferometer is so useful in detecting gravitational waves, let's think for a minute about what exactly a gravitational wave does as it passes through a portion of space. According to general relativity, the phenomena of gravity is really just the consequence of the geometry of space and time. So as a gravitational wave passes through space, that wave temporarily changes the geometry of that space. This is just like the way that a water wave temporarily changes the shape of the water surface, or a sound wave temporarily changes the distribution of molecules in the air. As a gravitational wave travels through space, it causes that space to expand and contract, stretching back and forth with time. When the wave is at a peak, two points in space will be farther apart from each other than they were before the wave was present. And when that wave is at a valley, the same two points in space will be closer to each other. Because of this, when a powerful gravitational wave passes through a laser interferometer, it can cause the distance of one or both of the laser's paths to alternate between being slightly longer and slightly shorter than it was before the wave entered. At any given moment, there are any number of physics students out there building laser ferometers as part of their education and training, perhaps as part of a course in modern physics, for example. So you should ask yourself, why aren't they already detecting gravitational waves all the time, left and right? Well, although everything I said about gravitational waves and what they do as they pass through a laser ferometer is true, I didn't mention one important thing. Gravitational waves, even the most powerful ones, only change the geometry of space by a very, very tiny degree. If you hope to detect one of these waves as it passes by, you'll need to build a very, very big interferometer. But over the past several decades, physicists have been busy doing just that, building bigger and more powerful laser interferometers in the hopes of making the first direct detection of a gravitational wave. The state of the art in these experiments is a project known as LIGO, which is short for the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory. LIGO consists of two huge laser interferometers, one in Louisiana and the other in Washington State. The lasers in these machines travel a full 8 kilometers round trip before they're recombined with each other. And they make this trip through a tunnel that is maintained at a nearly perfect vacuum, going through virtually empty space. The sensitivity of LIGO is incredible. It can detect even the tiniest expansions or contractions of space, corresponding to changes in length smaller than 10 to the minus 19 meters. That's about 10,000 times smaller than the size of a single proton. It took decades for scientists to plan and build LIGO, but these decades of effort finally paid off on September 14th of 2015, when they detected their first clear and definitive signal of a gravitational wave. The waves they observed were created from a merger of two black holes that took place about 1.3 billion years ago and about 1.3 billion light years away from us. These black holes were huge, about 29 and 36 times as massive as the sun. For billions of years, these two black holes have been steadily releasing gravitational radiation, causing them to move closer and closer to each other, tightening their orbit. As they got closer, they moved more and more quickly and released more and more energy into gravitational waves. In their final fraction of a second, they spiraled into each other at a speed of nearly half the speed of light, merging together to form a single, even bigger black hole. What LIGO was able to detect were the gravitational waves that were generated in this final fraction of a second that led up to the merger itself. When these gravitational waves finally reached us, they gently pulled on the fabric of space-time, stretching and squeezing the geometry of space within the LIGO detectors. Nothing like that had ever been witnessed before. A few months after that first detection, LIGO detected gravitational waves from yet another merger of two black holes, this time with masses of about 14 and 7 times that of the Sun. And a little over a year later, a third event of this kind was detected. In all likelihood, these three events are only the tip of the iceberg waiting to be discovered. On the one hand, they represented the important discovery of gravitational waves and an important test of Einstein's theory of general relativity. But on the other hand, these observations also represent the beginning of a new science of gravitational wave astronomy. Over the years and decades to come, scientists hope to use these kinds of detectors to learn about many systems with two black holes, or a black hole and a neutron star, how many exist in the universe, where they are, and how they're distributed. If we can detect a large enough number of these signals, it may even be possible to use them to measure the rate at which the universe is expanding, something that we'll talk about much more in the next two lectures. LIGO and other similar gravitational wave detectors undoubtedly have a very bright future ahead of them. Virtually all of my colleagues are on the edges of their seats in anticipation for what they hope they will learn in the years to come. But the future of gravitational wave science is not likely to be limited to these kinds of detectors. At this very moment, steps are being taken to embark on an even more ambitious experimental program, a program to study gravitational waves using laser interferometers deployed in space. LIGO is well suited to detect gravitational waves with frequencies between roughly 50 Hertz and 2000 Hertz, which means that it can detect waves that stretch and contract space at rates between 50 and 2000 times per second. For comparison, this is similar to the range of sound wave frequencies that can be heard by the human ear. In fact, the shape of a gravitational wave measured by LIGO can be translated into sound and listened to. I'm going to play for you now the sound of LIGO's first gravitational wave event. In case you missed it, let's listen again. You should be listening for a faint chirp-like sound. That chirp that you just heard is the sound of a merger of two enormous black holes. LIGO's frequency range is well suited to detect the mergers of certain kinds of black holes. But scientists also think that there are likely to be many interesting sources of gravitational waves at lower frequencies, frequencies far too low to be detected by any experiment on Earth. To observe these kinds of gravitational waves, you have to go into space. Plans are underway for a space-based gravitational wave detector called LISA, short for the Laser Interferometer Space Antenna, hopefully with a launch date of around 2030 or so. Like LIGO, LISA would be a laser interferometer. But instead of being located on the surface of the Earth, LISA would consist of a constellation of three spacecraft, forming an equilateral triangle of components in orbit around the Sun. And whereas each LIGO interferometer is about 4 kilometers from one end to the other, LISA will extend millions of kilometers through space. Because of its much greater size and its location in space, LISA will be able to detect gravitational waves of much lower frequencies than LIGO can, frequencies between about 0.0001 and 0.1 hertz. Over this range, physicists and astronomers expect LISA to be able to detect much larger black holes than LIGO can study, the kinds of supermassive black holes that are found in the centers of galaxies. LISA is also expected to detect tens of thousands of mergers between black holes, neutron stars, and white dwarf stars. And for me personally, the thing that I'm most excited about is the ability of LISA to tell us things about the universe's first fraction of a second after the Big Bang. Although cosmologists have learned an enormous amount about our universe and how it expanded and evolved since the Big Bang, we still know very little about the first fraction of a second of our universe's history. There's a chance that LISA may be able to detect gravitational waves that were produced during this very early era, teaching us more about our universe's origin and the transitions it underwent during its first moments. This provides us with a nice segue into the next lecture. In that lecture, I'm going to talk about what Einstein's theory has to say about our universe as a whole. We'll talk about the expansion of space and the beginning of the branch of science that's known as cosmology.